Tom Woods Show, episode 1920.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year, the 2000th episode of the Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from the Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Well, today I want to take a magnifying glass to a classic text in our tradition. And it's a text that when I was sort of growing up as a libertarian, we knew about, but it didn't have quite the central role that it seems to today. And that may be because the Mises Institute has published it as a very small publication in its own right, and that is the Murray Rothbard essay, Anatomy of the State. That's an essay that you can find in Rothbard's book, Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Nature and Other Essays, which is a great book in itself. But they've taken that Anatomy of the State and published it on its own. And in doing so, and also publishing it online, they've reached an awful lot of people with it who consider it to be essential to their understanding and essential to maybe getting them out of customary ways of thinking about the state and helping them to think in fresh new ways. And I want to review it and comment on it a little bit in this episode, not only because it's so popular and it's an entry point for so many people, but also because, as you'll recall, in a fairly recent episode, I had Michael Malice on the show and we talked about his book, The Anarchist Handbook. Well, for the audiobook version of The Anarchist Handbook, I'm going to be reading Anatomy of the State. I will be the narrator for that chapter of the book. So I've been looking at it recently, and that spurred this episode idea in my mind. As long as I'm reading it again and thinking about it, why not do an episode about it? So let's say, first of all, a little something about Murray Rothbard. Most people listening will know who he is, but some of you folks don't yet know, and he was a truly extraordinary figure, 1926 to 1995. I remember Joe Sobrin saying, in light of the unbelievable productivity of Rothbard, not to mention his personality, which I just don't think you'd meet anybody like this guy, just full of zeal and enthusiasm and optimism and energy and curiosity, intellectual curiosity. Joe Sobrin once said that dying was the most uncharacteristic thing Rothbard ever did. Well, that's quite an insight. Rothbard was extraordinarily prolific. If he had done only one of the many, many things he did, all those would be, each one in itself would be a tremendous accomplishment that he could have retired on, in a sense, in terms of libertarianism anyway. So, for example, in 1962, he published a massive book called Man, Economy, and State. And Joe Sobrin, who is the academic vice president of the Mises Institute, credits Man, Economy, and State with keeping the Austrian School of Economics alive. Remember, Hayek won the Nobel Prize in 1974. And of course, the Austrian School of Economics really got started in 1871 with Principles of Economics by Karl Menger. And the Austrian school was quite mainstream for a long time until the profession took a particular turn and just, more or less became the handmaiden of the state, the apologist for state power. But it was widely respected, and of course it was the Austrians who simultaneously with Walras and Jevons discovered the principle of marginal utility, which is really what distinguishes modern economics from the classical school that preceded it. Well, anyway, the Austrian school was very much in danger of being eclipsed entirely. But that work by Rothbard kept the thing going. And when the famous South Royalton, Vermont conference took place in 1974 among the existing Austrians, every single person had been formed by that Rothbard book that was not merely an elaboration of Mises's book, Ludwig von Mises's book, Human Action, but made many contributions in its own right, and particularly the multiple chapters on production theory were written because Rothbard realized that Mises had simply taken for granted that people either knew or understood a lot of that material already. Well, that's not the case, and it needed to be fleshed out, and Rothbard did that. So it's an extremely important book, as Mises himself acknowledged both publicly and privately, urging people to read it. So Rothbard helped to keep the Austrian school alive with a tremendous book. In fact, if you were to read one of the two large Austrian treatises, namely Human Action and Man, Economy, and State. I mean, there are others. Money, Bank, Credit, and Economic Cycles by Jesus Huerta de Soto was another giant treatise, but that's focused on one aspect of economics. I'm talking about from the ground up, we have these two treatises squarely in the Austrian tradition, Human Action by Mises and Man, Economy, and State by Rothbard. I actually think you should read Man, Economy, and State first, because it's very linear in its presentation. It begins with the most fundamental, basic aspects of human action, and then proceeds systematically to more complex questions. Now, Mises does something somewhat like that, but he makes quite a few detours and has a few tangents that he goes on, which are all fascinating, and you can't live without any one of them. But if you just want a laser beam focus on the subject at hand, you can't find anything better than Man, Economy, and State. So you have that. Then the following year, Rothbard releases his extremely important book, America's Great Depression. That was also the year that Milton Friedman's view of the Great Depression came out, and that really swept the boards among free market people, that the problem was the Federal Reserve. And so that sounds like a kind of libertarian conclusion. But the Friedman view is the Federal Reserve didn't do enough or this or that. And that's not ever going to be Rothbard's view. The Federal Reserve did much too much. It created an artificial boom in the 1920s that had to unravel ultimately because it was unsustainable. So Rothbard defends that thesis very ably in the 1963 book, America's Great Depression. So America's Great Depression could also be thought of as the Great Depression, not the fault of capitalism, even though that's what everyone teaches you, including the so-called free market people. The so-called free market people will sometimes say, we love capitalism and it's great and it raises our living standards and it leads to higher wages and all these other good outcomes. But it also, you know, it has a tendency to have crashes and downturns and, well, you got to take the good with the bad. That's not Rothbard's style at all. And it's not correct. So those are just two, and I've read and thoroughly profited from both of those books. But Rothbard was also not just a great economic historian, but he was a great historian in general. He wrote an amazing four-volume history of colonial America, and now we actually have been able to dig out and publish what we have of the unfinished fifth volume and publish that. If he had done just that, that would be an amazing accomplishment. But then he also wrote a two-volume history of economic thought. If I just sat here, I could just list and listen. He was the editor of the Journal of Libertarian Studies. He was editor of the Review of Austrian Economics that later became the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. What he produced in terms of articles, books, lectures is just almost beyond comprehension that one person could do this. And that's why he was known as Mr. Libertarian. Got his PhD from Columbia University. His doctoral dissertation on the Panic of 1819 is more or less now the standard work on that subject, even in mainstream circles. I remember reading a book, now it's been so long, I can't remember the title so well. It's because my graduate studies are so far, long ago. But I remember reading a mainstream book on Jacksonian America. And I just looking in the bibliographical essay, the author just matter-of-factly said that Rothbard's book, The Panic of 1819, is unlikely to be superseded. And that was just mainstream historical judgment, that was not a libertarian writing that. So anyway, Rothbard did a lot of pioneering work. And of course, what distinguishes Rothbard from some other libertarians was that he went the whole way. He was what's called an anarcho-capitalist. So that is to say, his view was that there's nothing that government can create that's better than how the market would produce it. That if these general principles about the values of competition and the market economy and economic calculation under the profit and loss system as the system that optimizes the use of resources, then there's no reason to think that the state needs to provide X, Y, or Z. That the state's a coercive monopoly, and there is no instance in life in which coercive monopolies produce better results than a free market. What they result in are subpar products that tend to get worse over time and more expensive. And that pretty much seems to describe everything that the state provides for us. Now, of course, this is not something that most people come to instinctively or right away. Your instinct is, oh, that can't be right. I mean, what would we just have warring armies in the street? And of course, you have these sort of conventional objections. And there are a lot of people who have come along and responded even more effectively than Rothbard did to objections to his arguments. And I'm thinking here of Bob Murphy. Robert Murphy has done some extensive work on precisely those types of objections. And I've done some episodes of the Tom Woods Show at tomspodcast.com. You can see the entire list of all the episodes. And you can see that if you just do a search on page for Murphy, we've got a lot of good episodes covering topics like this. So Rothbard's view was that we don't need Nancy Pelosi for anything at all. Not only do we not need her for healthcare, we actually don't need her. That society can actually order itself. So anatomy of the state then is not going to take the view that, well, the state is a necessary evil, or it does provide some necessary services. That's not his view at all. So we're going to go through that and review some of the main ideas in it. And of course, naturally, I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1920. So the state, basically, he's going to start off with what the state is not. It's not any of the things you've been told it is. It's not a social service agency. It's certainly not an agency by which our collective will is implemented. So there's no we here. It's not that we are the government. He says these are the kinds of propagandistic slogans that get people to go along with it. It's the kind of thing that you get taught in school about the state. You don't get taught the brute fact that some people rule and other people are ruled. Instead, it's we rule ourselves. Even though, if I may adopt a formulation Rothbard uses in another context, there's a bit of obscuring going on here between who exactly is the we and who is the ourselves. I personally think that all these social contract theories, whereby we say that the state is the result of people rationally deciding among themselves that it's best to give up some rights to the, or some powers to a government, and then so that the ones that we retain can be more adequately protected by this government that we've created. I personally think that that is a result of the Enlightenment feeling distinctly uncomfortable with the idea of authority being imposed on others rather than emerging from people themselves, that the idea of an outside force ruling over you, well, they don't like that. I mean, of course, there were certainly people who believed in enlightened absolutism during the Enlightenment, so obviously some of them have no problem with it. But there's this, I think there was this feeling of awkwardness about that, about the idea of man being ruled. Just the brute fact of man being ruled made them uncomfortable. So they had to conceal this or make it seem like it wasn't really man being ruled. It was his free choice. He exercised his reason, which the Enlightenment claimed to emphasize, the faculty of reason. He used his reason to determine that the state was necessary, and he therefore, in using his reason to realize the necessity of this and to create this thing as a voice for himself and his fellow men, well, then he's really ruling himself, so that when the state imposes things on him, it's really him imposing the things on himself. And Rothbard just had absolutely no patience for this whatsoever. So he says, it can't be that if somebody is conscripted into the military, that he conscripted himself, or if you express the wrong opinion, as some people did under Woodrow Wilson, got thrown in jail for it, that you threw yourself in jail. I mean, this is all ridiculous, right? This is the kind of thing that you would expect from a cult. You would expect a cult to be this irrational and bizarre in the way it urges us to think about itself. He says, look, if then the state is not us, if it is not the human family getting together to decide mutual problems, if it is not a lodge meeting or country club, what is it? And he says, briefly, the state is that organization in society which attempts to maintain a monopoly of the use of force and violence in a given territorial area. In particular, it is the only organization in society that obtains its revenue not by voluntary contribution or payment for services rendered, but by coercion. While other individuals or institutions obtain their income by production of goods and services and by the peaceful and voluntary sale of these goods and services to others, the state obtains its revenue by the use of compulsion, that is, by the use and the threat of the jailhouse and the bayonet. So now, having given that definition and overview of the state, Rothbard moves into his section, What the State Is. And to elaborate on this, he uses this distinction by Franz Oppenheimer, the German sociologist, between the economic means to wealth and the political means. There are only two ways you can acquire wealth. One is through peaceful production and exchange, and the other is by looting people who have produced something of value. That's it. You can either produce something and sell it, and that, by the way, that includes you can sell the services of your labor, or you can go grab what somebody else has produced. Those are the two ways you can acquire wealth. The economic means, of course, is what has made civilization possible. The extension of the division of labor across the world and international and commerce from the local level all the way internationally has yielded us an extraordinary standard of living and civilized life. But now that we have this distinction in our minds between economic and political means to wealth, Rothbard says, well, the state is the organization of the political means to wealth. The state systematizes the political means to wealth because that is all the state can do. It has no resources of its own. Any resources it expends, it first acquires by looting producers. That is what it is. So anything romantic about the state, that it's this or it's that, or it's the, you know, as the fascists would say, it's somehow the embodiment of the people's destiny and will and all this mystical craziness, or any of the social democratic arguments about the state existing for the welfare of mankind. Okay, well, say that all you like, but the brute fact is it's an institution that violates the rules that we live under all other circumstances. You're not allowed to just seize people's resources because you think you have a better use for them than they do. You can't do that. Individuals can't do these sorts of things. We'd be thrown in jail. But the state does them, and we're taught to consider it a virtue. Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. There is plenty of discussion of Bitcoin these days. A lot of I told you so's floating around out there and a lot of interest in it. And I have just the thing for people who are looking to add Bitcoin to their retirement account, looking to diversify their portfolio toward new innovative investments, or who just find the cryptocurrency world confusing and don't know how to get started. Well, some people are saying crypto assets present the best opportunity to build generational wealth since the discovery of oil. And BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption, and they have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. Well, go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. Then, in his section, How the State Preserves Itself, Rothbard wonders, well, if what we have here with the state is a small minority ruling over a large majority and plundering them, how does this persist? Why doesn't the large majority rise up against this injustice? And he says, well, now here we have the critical role of the intellectuals in helping to form opinion, whether that's through education, sponsored, of course, by the state itself, or through the various media of mass communication. The intellectuals weave defenses of the state in various ways, and that can either be by seeking to discredit other forms of political association or forms of non-rule. These things need to be discredited, made to seem ridiculous to people, that of course you need good King so-and-so, or of course you need good Mr. President so-and-so, because look at the alternative, citizen. You certainly wouldn't want that, now would you? Now think about the kind of, again, because so many people listen because of COVID, think of the COVID propaganda, right? You just, you hear it and you wince. You think, oh gosh, this is so transparent. Well, there's a possibility that's the kind of propaganda we have about the state itself. Now, what do the intellectuals get out of this? How do they benefit from defending the state? Well, realize that intellectuals enjoy a fairly precarious existence on the free market because the demand for their services is not particularly great. I mean, without the state, can you imagine all these people peddling critical race theory? What would they do for a living? I mean, they'd actually have to do something productive. Or all these crazy academic journal articles that are all just gobbledygook. In fact, a feminist journal not that long ago accidentally published a chapter of Mein Kampf that had just had some words substituted, like women and feminism had been inserted for other words, and they accidentally published a chapter of Mein Kampf. And that's how far gone these people are. That doesn't happen. There's no way that's going to survive on a free market. No way. That's because that's being subsidized. And so the intellectuals get some kind of support for themselves, and then they wind up being the vanguard of the defense of the state itself. So they wind up doing things like claiming that government spending activates a multiplier effect that leads to a multiplication of benefits for everybody concerned. Now, if a group of robbers had simply taken over a society at gunpoint and tried to tell them that by looting you, we're activating a multiplier effect that is going to improve everybody's standard of living, well, we would just dismiss that derisively. We wouldn't entertain that for a second. We would realize these are self-interested people who are somehow trying to trick me into thinking that my having my property taken away from me is actually good because it's going to multiply all these other subsidiary economic effects. What are you talking about? Right? But in the present condition where they've got charts and graphs and math and the veneer of sophistication, well, somehow they're able to get away with nonsense like this. Then we come to Rothbard's section, how the state transcends its limits. And he points out a problem that's not really addressed by very many people, which is that, for example, in the case of the United States, it is said that if there are disputes about the extent of the state's own powers, well, they will be settled by one final authority, namely a Supreme Court. That will decide whether the state has gone beyond its allowable limits. But the problem, of course, is that that court is itself part of the federal government. So there's no way it's an impartial arbiter. It is part of the very institution whose powers are under examination. And so therefore, the government is acting as an actor in its own case. This is the kind of thing that is rejected in every other situation. You would not allow yourself, if you have a vested interest in the matter at hand, if you are one of the two parties, you can't be the judge in that case. You can't be a judge of your own case. And clearly, the state is. And as Rothbard shows, this problem is either ignored or just dismissed by the, you know, intellectual defenders of the state. But it is a problem. And he entertains Calhoun, John C. Calhoun's solution. He's, of course, the 19th century political theorist and indeed senator and vice president. Calhoun, in his Disquisition on Government, has a lot of important stuff to say, not just the Disquisition on Government. His other writings are very worth reading. And back in the old days, Liberty Fund, which publishes inexpensive editions of important works, back when people weren't spooked into not publishing people like Calhoun because hypochondriac libertarians will criticize them. Well, don't you know that Calhoun supported slavery? Will be this is the endless response you get. But they published a great collection of Calhoun's essays called Union and Liberty, which is very, very worth reading or at least having on your shelf. Anyway, Calhoun proposes something called the concurrent majority. And Calhoun's view was that if you have some substantial minority interest in the country, specifically a state government that thinks the federal government has gone beyond its constitutional powers, then this minority could declare it to be unconstitutional. Now, wouldn't be, by the way, Rothbard doesn't elaborate on this, but it would not be that the law would function in all the other states and just not in the nullifying one. The way Calhoun conceived of this would be that if a state, so just a state, objected on constitutional grounds to a particular federal law, then that law would be considered as suspended, pending further discussion or an amendment of the Constitution. If the Constitution is then amended such that the disputed power is now expressly granted to the federal government, then the nullifying state would have a decision on its hands. Can it live with this law, or does it wish to secede from the Union? And you may say, well, gee, how would the federal government get anything done? Yeah, that's kind of the point. Is that, I mean, just look at what the federal government does most of the time. Would we miss much of this? Would we really miss it if states were blocking it from time to time? Would we miss it? I'm not sure we would. Now, Rothbard's objection to Calhoun's view, which he calls path-breaking and he considers very important, is that it doesn't go far enough. I mean, why should a state government be the only minority interest? How about entire professions that can be affected by federal government action? Or why stop at the state level? Why not go down to the city or the ward and so on? And I have no objection to that at all. As somebody who's written a book in defense of nullification, I agree with him. Yes, of course, it could go much farther. I absolutely agreed. But it's something, is my point. And it's rooted in American history. And as I show in my book, Nullification, the arguments for it are really overwhelming, historically and constitutionally. They're really overwhelming. And I realize this comes as a surprise to people because this is not what you're taught in law school. That's for sure. You're taught John Marshall and federalism. Federalism with a capital F, not the good lowercase kind. That's what you're taught. You're taught the single consolidated union. You're taught all this nonsensical stuff that's based on nothing. But the people who defend this compact theory of the union, that this is a compact among states, and the states are the parties to this compact, and they are ultimately the deciders of constitutionality, that's the only deciders we could have. They can't create something that's more powerful than they are. They can't create a Supreme Court that tells them what they're supposed to think about the very thing they themselves created. This is nonsense. The arguments for it are very, very convincing. So I'll link to my book, Nullification, on the show notes page because it's very worth reading, I think, by the way, because it's the chapter on the compact versus the nationalist theories of the Union is, I think, the most succinct treatment of that subject you can find anywhere. I'm not saying it's the best treatment, because there are longer treatments on it. But if you want a concise treatment with all the evidence you could ask for, it's in my book, Nullification. And you can get the audiobook for free, by the way, if you've never joined Audible before. Just go to tomwoodsaudio.com, and you can get Nullification for free when you sign up. And then if you decide you don't want to stick with Audible, you can cancel, and they let you keep the free audiobook. So I am encouraging you to go get my audiobook for nothing at tomwoodsaudio.com. So I agree with Rothbard. You could go much farther than Calhoun, but at least it's something. I mean, even as far as Calhoun goes, it's considered out of bounds by the intellectuals who defend the state today. Then we have the section, what the state fears. And of course, it fears any fundamental threat to its own power and its own existence. And in this section, Rothbard makes rather an important point. He says, we may test the hypothesis that the state is largely interested in protecting itself rather than its subjects, which is Rothbard's thesis, that the state, although it tries to get legitimacy for itself by claiming that it's providing services to us, keeping us safe and all that, he says, by asking which category of crimes does the state pursue and punish most intensely, those against private citizens or those against itself? The gravest crimes in the state's lexicon, Rothbard says, are almost invariably not invasions of private person or property, but dangers to its own contentment. For example, treason, desertion of a soldier to the enemy, failure to register for the draft, subversion and subversive conspiracy, assassination of rulers, and such economic crimes against the state as counterfeiting its money or evasion of its income tax. Or compare the degree of zeal devoted to pursuing the man who assaults a policeman with the attention that the state pays to the assault of an ordinary citizen. I'm going to skip over the section on how states relate to one another. You can read the whole thing, remember, at the link on the show notes page, or listen to the audiobook version when it comes out for Malice, and go right to the concluding section, History as a Race Between State Power and Social Power. And I'm just going to read this brief concluding section to you. Just as the two basic and mutually exclusive interrelations between men are peaceful cooperation or coercive exploitation, production or predation, so the history of mankind, particularly its economic history, may be considered as a contest between these two principles. On the one hand, there is creative productivity, peaceful exchange and cooperation. On the other, coercive dictation and predation over those social relations. Albert J. Nock happily termed these contesting forces social power and state power. Social power is man's power over nature, his cooperative transformation of nature's resources and insight into nature's laws for the benefit of all participating individuals. Social power is the power over nature, the living standards achieved by men in mutual exchange. State power, as we have seen, is the coercive and parasitic seizure of this production, a draining of the fruits of society for the benefit of non-productive, actually anti-productive, rulers. While social power is over nature, state power is power over man. Through history, man's productive and creative forces have time and again carved out new ways of transforming nature for man's benefit. These have been the times when social power has spurted ahead of state power, and when the degree of state encroachment over society has considerably lessened. But always, after a greater or smaller time lag, the state has moved into these new areas to cripple and confiscate social power once more. If the 17th through the 19th centuries were, in many countries of the West, times of accelerating social power and a corollary increase in freedom, peace, and material welfare, the 20th century has been primarily an age in which state power has been catching up, with a consequent reversion to slavery, war, and destruction. In this century, the human race faces once again the virulent reign of the state now armed with the fruits of man's creative powers, confiscated and perverted to its own aims. The last few centuries were times when men tried to place constitutional and other limits on the state, only to find that such limits, as with all other attempts, have failed. Of all the numerous forms that governments have taken over the centuries, of all the concepts and institutions that have been tried, none has succeeded in keeping the state in check. The problem of the state is evidently as far from solution as ever. Perhaps new paths of inquiry must be explored if the successful final solution of the state question is ever to be attained. Now, that is the kind of stuff that makes people's heads explode. But let it marinate in that brain of yours. Let it marinate for a little while. There are many other works you can read and podcast episodes you can listen to in defense of Rothbard's analysis. Even if you come to the conclusion, well, we still do need the state, at least you're operating under no illusions about what's really going on here. I have a talk that I gave that I made into an episode of this show called Four Things the State Is Not. And I think that's one of the best talks I've ever given. And in some ways, it's inspired by Rothbard. But what I do is I give example after example after example. There aren't a lot of specific examples because in Rothbard's essay, because it's a theoretical treatment. But I then put flesh on the bones in a sense by coming up with a whole bunch of examples illustrating that this really is the case about the state and that these myths we've been led to believe about it are clearly untrue. So I'll link to that also at tomwoods.com/1920. So if you like and appreciate what goes on the Tom Woods Show, I hope you'll become a supporting listener of the show, and I hope you'll join me at the 2000th episode event in Orlando in October and have a great time there. And if you're part of the supporting listeners group, you also get to attend a special reception where I will be mingling and meeting and saying hello to and taking pictures with as many people as I possibly can. So I hope you'll do that. tomwoods2000.com is the website for that. And to be a supporting listener, join my elite is the pathway to that is supportinglisteners.com. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.